Australians take to the streets in major cities, demanding that the indigenous people are given a voice to address the inequalities that they face. Thanks for joining us. The death toll from catastrophic flooding in Libya's eastern city of Derna has climbed to 11,300. This figure is expected to rise, with the UN saying another 10,000 people are still missing in the city. Outside of Derna, the flooding took an additional 170 lives. Search and rescue efforts are continuing nearly a week after Storm Daniel hit northeastern Libya. The UN says the humanitarian situation remains particularly grim in Derna, where two dams have collapsed. Severe drinking water problems have now gripped the city. In the surrounding areas, the UN has also warned of the dangers of landmines shifting from floodwaters, threatening civilians. Libya has been plagued by intermittent armed conflict for years. The military leaders of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger have signed a mutual defense pact as the three Sahel countries seek to help each other against possible threats of an external aggression.
Any attack on the sovereignty and territorial integrity of one or more of the contracting parties will be considered as an aggression against the other parties and will entail a duty of assistance and relief on the part of all parties.
The pact also binds the three countries to work to prevent or to settle armed rebellions. This comes as the West African Regional Bloc, ECOWAS, has threatened to intervene militarily in Niger over the ouster of President Mohamed Bazoum. Mali and Burkina Faso have responded by saying that any such operation would be deemed a declaration of war against them. Meanwhile, anti-French sentiment is growing in Niger as Paris insists on supporting the ousted President Mohamed Bazoum. Thousands of protesters have gathered outside of a French military base in the capital Niamey to demand the departure of the French soldiers.
We don't want France today. We don't want France tomorrow. All they have to do is leave our country alone. All they have to do is go home. That's all.
People rallied outside of the French base wearing and waving the country's flag. They expressed their full support for the country's military government. Protesters demanded that Western countries, especially France, respect their choice of government. Niger's leaders have renounced several military cooperation agreements with Paris, saying that French forces are now illegally stationed in the country. France has about 1,500 soldiers stationed there. Iran says that it will continue its positive cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency, despite the decision to bar some of the agency's inspectors assigned to the country. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman issued the statement after the IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, criticized Tehran for barring several inspectors. Nasser Kanani said Iran's decision was based on its safeguards agreements with the agency, which allows countries to veto inspectors. Elaborating on the reason behind the move, Kanani said that Iran had earlier warned about the consequences of attempts to politicize the agency. He was referring to an anti-Iran statement by the U.S., Britain, France, and Germany at the IAEA's Board of Governors this week, which accused the country of non-compliance with its commitments. Kanani said these countries exploited the IAEA's Board of Governors to advance their anti-Iran political agenda, despite the fact that Iran had engaged in constructive and positive cooperation with the agency. International lawyer Barry Grossman earlier joined us from Bali, Indonesia, to tell us more about the objectives of the latest anti-Iran measures by the West.
I think it needs to be said that compliance with the inspection regime, whether it's based on the JCPO or Iran's membership in the nuclear as a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, doesn't mean compliance with any demand made of it, okay? And I say that against a backdrop which saw Iran basically compelled to negotiate what became known as the JCPOA, which is rather misaptly named. It's not a joint treaty, it's a multilateral treaty, which the U.S. rejected no sooner than the ink was dry on their signature. the promised relief from sanctions. And to be clear, the JCPO spelled out an obligation on all signatory parties to remove all sanctions against Iran, has never been delivered. The United States and its allies have continued to make their animosity towards Iran patently obvious, continue to take part in covert action against Iran, which seems calculated to generate political unrest.
Iran security forces have nabbed a team linked to a terror group that was planning attacks on an illegal gathering in the western province of Kurdistan on the anniversary of last year's unrest. Security officials say the team had entered Iran from Iraq's Kurdistan region and was planning to carry out the attack in the city of Saqlez on Friday. Four terrorists have been arrested, along with assault rifles, handguns, Iranian military uniforms, and knives. According to a statement from Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, several other terrorist teams were also arrested in other Western cities. Terrorist groups based in Iraq's Kurdistan region have staged several attacks inside of Iran, concurrent with the 2022 riots in the country. Recently, Iranian officials have issued several warnings of a new plot by enemies to stir unrest on the anniversary of the riots that broke out following the death of Mahsa Amini, a young Iranian woman, last year. On Saturday, Iranian security forces foiled a murder attempt on the father of Mahsa Amini. The eighth edition of an international conference dubbed Resistance Fighters Abroad has been held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This year's edition has awarded Sayyid Isa Tabatabai, who served as a representative for Imam Khomeini and the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, in Lebanon for more than four decades. Gisumi Shahmadi has the details.
Honoring all those who anonymously helped the resistance front, prominent Iranian officials and international resistance scholars and activists, and a number of Hezbollah senior commanders attended the eighth edition of a conference dubbed Resistance Fighters Abroad to honor yet another influential figure for his lifelong commitment to the resistance front with their special Lifetime Achievement Award.
Today we can see how the resistance front is growing as a result of the hard work of people like Hojatul Islam wal Muslimin Sayyid Isa Tabatabai. As you probably know, he was born in Najaf and came to Iran as a teenager and continued his studies in Qom and then moved to Lebanon because he was facing oppression. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, he was appointed as the representative of Imam Khomeini in Lebanon and later the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, leaving a great record behind.
The resistance front today is in a very good position. The Israeli regime has had to alter its plans and limit its moves because of the resistance front. We owe all of these achievements to resistance fighters and all of those who are assisting the resistance. In this context, we owe people like Haji Isa Tabatabai a lot.
The unveiling ceremony of his biography, along with the unveiling of a commemorative stamp, made this year's ceremony even more special.
I believe that every now and then in our region, we need to call out the names of those who have dedicated their lives to the resistance front out loud. This is the main purpose of the conference on resistance fighters abroad.
Traditionally, the annual conference is held on the martyrdom anniversary of the all-time role model of resistance fighters abroad, the 8th Shia Imam, Imam Reza alayhi salam, who was martyred far away from his homeland in the Iranian city of Mashhad, and ends on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam, the 11th Shia Imam.
The closing ceremony of the conference will be held next week on the 24th of September in the holy city of Mashhad, northeastern Iran. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Pakistan's economic experts and the business community have called on the government to boost energy trade with Iran so that the country can overcome its ongoing energy crisis. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi has more in this report from Islamabad.
Pakistan has been facing an acute energy crisis for many years. To overcome the energy needs of the country, a national energy conference was organized in Islamabad to explore ways to handle the energy supply deficiency. The conference was attended by energy experts, economists, traders and political activists. The business community expressed its serious concerns over growing energy deficit in the country, demanding the government to defy the U.S. requests and move to import cheaper electricity and gas supplies from neighboring countries, especially Iran.
We have an abundant resource of energy next door, but due to international political pressures, we are unable to tap that resource, which will be good for our economy plus the economy of our neighbor.
Analysts say the energy crisis poses serious threats to Pakistan's fragile economy and national security environment, urging the government to further strengthen economic ties with Tehran.
Yes, the option is very nice. And we have no other chance other than to connect our all gas-fired power plant with the Iranian gas plant, with the Iranian gas pipeline, and that is already terminated at the border.
Allah has blessed us with the abundant renewable resources, and if we decide that okay, we have to go for it, okay, like our neighbors are doing it, okay, in only 5 years, okay, we can go for 100% renewable energy. It's not a big deal.
Meanwhile, Iran's ambassador to Pakistan reiterated that Tehran is ready to help Islamabad meet its energy needs. He said closer energy partnership between the two countries can strengthen their bilateral relations and promote regional stability.
We know that the Pakistani people are in dire need of energy, and we are ready to provide cheaper gas supplies to Pakistan.
Political activists say Pakistan's decision to import cheaper energy supplies from neighboring Iran would offer a promising avenue towards greater economic growth, energy security, and environmental sustainability.
Expanding energy trade with Iran will not only foster economic and diplomatic ties between Islamabad and Tehran, but will also help Pakistan to modernize its infrastructure and harness its energy potential more effectively. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Israeli forces have attacked Muslim worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds. Israeli troopers assaulted and beat up three worshippers near one of the main entrances of the compound. Regime forces have intensified their presence around the Al-Aqsa Mosque and prevent the entry of Palestinian citizens. Meanwhile, scores of settlers have entered the compound. This latest incident adds to the ongoing tensions surrounding the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has vowed to defend the holy place against the Israeli incursions. Representatives of Yemen's Ansarullah movement have been invited to the Saudi capital Riyadh to negotiate with Saudi officials potential solutions aimed at ending the war. Our correspondent Yusuf Mowry reports.
Peace talks between Ansarullah and Saudi delegates are in progress in the Saudi kingdom's capital. In this round of negotiations, the focus is on finding ways to alleviate the humanitarian crisis caused by the Saudi-led war in Yemen. The head of the Ansarullah National Delegation Team, Muhammad Abdesalam, believes if talks are successful, it could lead to an ultimate political solution.
No doubt we will discuss the payment of salaries to Yemeni employees, opening the airports and seaports, prisoner exchange, the withdrawal of all foreign military forces, and rebuilding Yemen, which could lead to a political solution.
One of the main topics to be discussed is the presence of foreign military personnel scattered throughout areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition. In recent years, the Yemeni islands have been transformed into military bases and airfields operated by the UAE and Western military forces.
There can be no peace until foreign military troops withdraw from Yemeni islands and withdraw forces from the provinces of Hadhramaut, Ma'rib, and Shabwa. If the occupation does not end, there will never be peace.
Even if peace talks succeed in ending the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, will it be enough to end the war if foreign forces remain in the country?
The Ansarullah delegation has made it very clear. Foreign military troops must leave the entire Yemeni land. And if this is something that is not accomplished through peaceful negotiations, the Ansarullah-backed government will continue to fight. Yusuf Mowry, Sana'a.
Thousands of Australians take to the streets in major cities to rally support for the October 14 referendum on whether to recognize First Nations in the Constitution. The Walk for Yes demonstrators marched in Sydney, Melbourne, and capital Canberra, among other places. They held signs demanding the Indigenous people be given a voice to address the inequalities they face. That is through constitutional rights to be consulted on policies that affect them. The Indigenous now have shorter lives than other Australians. They have poor education and are far more likely to die in police custody. The rally comes as the reforms are losing public support, with just 40% backing it, a turnaround since a year ago. And that is it for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. They have organized in what is known as the Black Lives Matter campaign to get the message across that all lives are of equal value, no matter the color of the skin. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
So we were just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a pit permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit, with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation. I'm really glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout.
Just get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
Yeah. I think that'll be powerful with it tied, like, on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, like the...
whatever size their shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there too. So it's going to, yeah, it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children, because this is something that can't be argued. Like, exactly. Even you can play devil's advocate, but these are children.
Exactly.
Children are harmless, so...
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that this is something that I have to do. I have to do this. We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing. And he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the witnesses who basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun, and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other, so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together, the code of silence, and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters. Police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality in Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working peoples of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
A state of emergency has been declared in the U.S. city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, since Monday, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, he was We don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But, I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from how it used to be. So I am going to head out there, see what's going on, see what I can learn from it, see how I can help, how I can support. But I just can't stay here in New York and not do anything at this point. So I'm heading out there.
Breaking news from Baltimore, a city on edge since the death of a suspect while in police custody, his spine nearly severed. Tonight, those tensions fueling violent protests now. Dramatic images coming in at this hour. You can see some people on the streets there throwing rocks and bricks at police officers.
On April 19th, 2015, 23-year-old Freddie Gray Jr., an African-American man, died in a Baltimore hospital after sustaining injuries while being transported in a police van. Gray had been arrested a week before by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police said was an illegal switchblade. Gray's hospitalization and subsequent death resulted in an ongoing series of protests. On April 25th, 2015, a major protest in downtown Baltimore turned violent, resulting in 34 arrests and injuries to 15 police officers. After Gray's funeral on April 27th, civil disorder intensified with the looting and burning of local businesses and a drugstore, resulting in a state of emergency declared by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. The Maryland National Guard was deployed to Baltimore, and a curfew was put into place.
I went there expecting the worst because I had seen the National Guard on TV and I had seen like how occupied they were by the military. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but surprisingly, it seemed that they were protecting mostly the harbor, the downtown harbor. That's where all of the National Guard really was, and it seemed that that was what their attention was focused on protecting. I think the media tried to kind of instill fear so that the same thing wouldn't happen in New York. But with Baltimore, it was the young children not feeling heard. It was mostly young children. All of the programs out there are cut for them. There's really nothing for them after school or part-time job-wise out there. So these children, they felt unheard, and their thing was to take to the streets. They were emotional. They started destroying, you know, things that they didn't feel were beneficial to the community.
The narrative around Baltimore, first of all, was that it was a riot. And I don't like that terminology because it's an uprising. It's cause and effect. When people are living in pervasive poverty and homelessness and joblessness, and on top of that, you add to that the current political climate where we see, not that it wasn't happening before, but where we see an overabundance of cops shooting and killing unarmed men, that was a natural response to those conditions. As with every other protest that has happened throughout this country in response to this issue, there was a negative slant put on it. They wanted to paint these people as savages instead of looking at the cause and effect. And they also didn't focus on the days that preceded what they call the riot, where people were actually in the streets peacefully protesting. So, of course, they're gonna spin it.
On May 21st, a grand jury indicted several of the officers involved with Gray's arrest. But in December 2015, a Baltimore judge declared a mistrial in the trial of one officer after the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The images of police wearing helmets and masks, toting assault rifles, and riding in mine-resistant armored vehicles in Baltimore and Ferguson has also raised widespread criticism of what has been dubbed the militarization of local police forces.
Difference, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years, you've got the intense militarization of police departments. So the police department still engaged in arbitrary policing when I was growing up, but they didn't have the military equipment that they have now. And the very fact that what the last 10 years or so, every 28 hours, is a black or brown person who's killed by a police or a security guard.
I think that military-grade equipment should be allocated to police department, but never, ever used against civilians. Military-grade equipment should be used in active shootings, shooter situation, some terrorist attack, but never against a civilian unrest. And I, in my mind, it was a horrible error of judgment.
We need action. By action, I mean transformation of institutions. By action, I mean redistribution of the wealth downward. By action, I mean high-quality jobs, high-quality education. By action, I mean high-quality communities where people can live with dignity. By action, I mean police who are accountable, who are punished by law if they murder other folk, arbitrarily treat other folk in ways in which they ought not. So we're talking about just radical democracy. We need people's power. We need the sharing of power.
Unfortunately, I think that what we've seen with the killings of the officers in New York in 2014 and what we've seen in Dallas recently, unfortunately, I think that this is not the end of retaliation against law enforcement officers by certain individuals who feel that police profession and officers, no matter what department they come from, represent this oppressive and brutal treatment of minorities. After all, if somebody thinks about democracy and democratic principle and wanting to live in a democratic country, they have to realize that policing is a pillar of democracy. And if there are issues of concern, these issues of concern have to be discussed and have to be brought to the attention of the local politicians, but never, ever they should be translated into any violent behavior, especially towards the ones who overall are charged with the protection of all of us.
One major goal that we have is to tie federal funding of local police forces to a prerequisite that they provide data regarding their shootings, especially in the cases of when they're shooting unarmed civilians, and then also to tie that to the mandatory use of body cameras. So that's a huge goal because I think transparency is necessary. I don't think there's enough data out there, and so that's another reason why people are able to dismiss this issue. Another goal is to have an independent prosecutor to prosecute police when in cases of police violence, especially against unarmed people, because I think it will restore faith for those of us who have lost it in our criminal justice system. People believe that the grand jury system is antiquated and leaves police to kill with impunity. And so I think that this would be one way to help resolve that issue.
You know, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I protest? And because it's an ongoing problem, and I can pretend that it's not going on, I can pretend that it's not happening, but there will be a new hashtag to learn, there'll be a new face the next day. And so we continue to march and move forward and get more organized and get serious, because I don't want my children to still be marching. My grandparents marched, my mother was involved in activism work, and so I don't want to pass this along. I want to be able to tell them the story of how we overcame, how we were able to come together and fight this greater evil, and just, I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
You don't know when the catalyst will be in place. Why did Rosa Parks become the catalyst as opposed to the earlier black woman who sat down on the bus just a few months earlier? It's hard to say when the spark in place takes off, the fire begins to expand, intensifies, and the next thing you know, you got a whole host of people on fire for justice. And lo and behold, people take off and it becomes contagious. You don't know when it's going to become contagious. It is contagious now. We are still living in the moment of Ferguson, Baltimore, and things will continue and I hope intensify.
I was told that I'm an activist from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? That when my daughter get older, this will still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, the brown lives, if black lives matter. That's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folk.
Well, for now, it seems that police brutality and racial injustice is not going to stop in the U.S. in the near future. And statistics show that many black Americans are skeptical that their country will ever make the changes necessary for racial equality. Perhaps only time will tell if America will ever be the land of the free. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another program here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم dear listeners you are listening to IRIB English Radio This is the program of For a Better Life I am Bita at your service and in this episode again we're going to talk about something really controversial and important for having a better life Today we're here to talk more about the social aspect of a life of a Muslim and an individual who wants to have a better life. As you know, society is defined as an enduring and cooperating social group whose members have developed organized patterns of relationships through interactions with one another. Our world is vast and made up of many societies, each having their own special pattern of relationships connected through language, customs, or common interests. These societies tend to close themselves to others who do not share these common factors. So this is true for all societies except one. Muslims come from many countries. Indeed, we cannot find any country on earth today that doesn't boast a Muslim community of some size. They speak different languages, have different customs, and generally, because of their specific environment, have different interests and goals. What makes this society of more than 1 billion people so special is that they all share a common belief in superior religion, a religion based on brotherhood and peace. Therefore, a Muslim from Nigeria has no fear of, apprehension and interaction when meeting a Muslim from Chicago or Venezuela or Iran or wherever, every part of this world. So, the bond between all Muslims is the single phrase. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. So, we have 1 billion brothers and sisters across the world just believing. Without any confusion, without any kind of conflict. Despite all of the differences they have, it doesn't matter whether it is about the language, customs, habits, or whatever. So, the belief makes the Muslim society, or Ummah, one of the most unique and the largest in all history. A society as we defined it is enduring. What makes it so? You know, propagation of its message and guidelines not only familiarize those who are estranged to its ideas, but also helps the society itself to better understand its own responsibilities. Islam is not a closed society. It is open to all of God's creation and invites all to actually take part in its refreshing and cleaning atmosphere. What are the responsibilities of this great society, and what is the responsibility of Muslim in the society? It's exactly the thing that we are talking about it after a short break.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. Your love is all I need. It's all I need. Your love is all I need. It's all I need. Your love is all I need. All I need. Your love is all I need. Oh. All I need to be all I need, and I know that you see how much you mean to me.
Talking about society, social life, and Ummah, or the Muslim society, we get to this point that we defined society, and then we talked about the responsibilities that every individual should actually make in order to have the perfect society, and every society has special responsibilities too. So every individual has some kind of responsibilities on their own and has some social responsibilities too. The Messenger of Allah said, "No foot of a servant of Allah will move on the resurrection day before being asked about four things: his years and how he spent them, his body and how he used it, his wealth and how he earned and spent it, and about his love towards us, the Ahlul Bayt." So, let me give you an explanation over this beautiful quote. A narration: the Prophet of Allah Muhammad, peace be upon him, teaches us through his glorious tradition hadith that it is obligatory to make use of the blessings and the bounties that Almighty Allah granted us. It also explains to us that we are held accountable for the way we use our time, property, health, and strength, and we should use them properly in the life of this world. So, if you have a blessing, you have a responsibility from another side that you have to go through that burden and responsibility. Surely, Allah the Most High created man and gave him life for a certain time. He gave him wisdom, strength, free will, wealth, etc. to enable him to use them in doing good and useful deeds, obtaining knowledge and worshipping him. So, as I told you, before every blessing, there is a reason. And for a reason, there is a responsibility. And in order to know these responsibilities, you have to gain knowledge. And these are the first steps you have to take in order to make yourself a proper human being for a better life. So, let's have a short break, then we're going to come back.
Hello.
Dear listeners, this is IRB English Radio. You're listening to For a Better Life. We are back here again talking about the social responsibilities of a person in order to have a better life. As you know, In the last part of the episode, we were talking about the definition of the society and the actually responsibilities that Allah Almighty will put on every individual's shoulder for every blessing that they are provided with. Accordingly, man must be aware of his responsibility. He must feel a responsibility to Allah on the resurrection day. Thus, Allah the Almighty will hold him to account on the day for the wealth that he gave him and how he obtained and used it. Did he obtain it through lawful means like, I don't know, agriculture, industry, trading, so on? Or through unlawful ways like deceiving others, robbery, oppression, and the like? If he earned it through unlawful actions, his lot will be punishment and torture. If his wealth was gained through lawful means, most surely Allah will reward him and will be pleased with him. On the resurrection day, man will be questioned about the property that he owned in the life of this world and how he used it. Did he spend it on forbidden deeds such as drinking alcohol, gambling, and so on? Or did he spend it on himself and his family, particularly participating in establishing useful and charitable projects and foundations to help the poor and needy? So, what is the value chose? It is the most important responsibility in everybody's life. So, at the end part of this episode, I want to remind you of your way. Which one of these two paths that I just clarified for you did you choose? You have to think carefully about your road, then find your responsibility and go for that. Thank you for listening to me. It was all the time I had for this episode. I bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows. Oh, Allah
in the limelight.
A new study says microplastics infiltrate all systems of mammals' bodies, including the brain, causing behavioral changes. The research involved exposing young and old mice to varying levels of microplastics in drinking water over the course of 3 weeks. Synthetic textiles such as polyester and nylon are a leading source of microplastic pollution, which has been identified worldwide, from the peak of Mount Everest to uninhabited Antarctica. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Vion wrote, microplastics are already a health scare, and a number of studies are being carried out to determine the extent of the damage they cause to our bodies. A new study has painted an even scarier picture. An experiment on mice has revealed that microplastics introduced through drinking water accumulated in almost every part of the mammal's bodies, even the brain. These mice even showed behavioral changes which were similar to dementia in humans. The study has pointed at a scary possibility that microplastics are breaching the immune barrier between the rest of the body and nervous system to enter the brain. The study was carried out by experts at the University of Rhode Island and published in International Journal of Molecular Science. To us, this was striking. These were not high doses of microplastics, but in only a short period of time, we saw these changes. explains neuroscientist Jamie Ross, as quoted on the University of Rhode Island website, adding, "Nobody really understands the life cycle of these microplastics in the body, so part of what we want to address is the question of what happens as you get older. Are you more susceptible to systematic inflammation from these microplastics as you age? Can your body get rid of them as easily? Do your cells respond differently to these toxins?" It is not a given that results obtained in experiments with mice would directly point at possible effects on humans, but such a study is often the first step to subsequently determine how humans are affected. In this experiment, young and old mice were given water treated with microplastics, which were made of fluorescent polystyrene. Some of the mice were given normal water to establish a reference point. It was a 3-week trial. The behavior of the mice was regularly monitored during open field tests. These tests encouraged exploratory behavior. As compared to the control group of mice, which was given normal water to drink, the mice who drank microplastic-contaminated water for the duration of 3 weeks reportedly showed significant behavioral changes. Older mice seemed to exhibit these changes to a greater degree. After 3 weeks, it was found that microplastics were present in every type of tissues of the mice that the team examined. The organs included liver, kidney, heart, spleen, lungs, and most importantly, brain. The microplastics were even found in the excrements of the mice. The website of Science Alert also wrote, "Scientists investigating the possible health effects of microplastics have uncovered some disturbing initial results in an experiment based on mice. When old and young rodents drank microplastic fragments of plastic suspended in their water over a course of 3 weeks, researchers at the University of Rhode Island found traces of pollutants had accumulated in every organ of the tiny mammal's body, including the brain. The presence of these microplastics was also accompanied by behavioral changes akin to dementia in humans, as well as changes to immune markers in the liver and brain. Recently, scientists have found microplastics hiding in the human intestine, circulating in our bloodstream, gathering deep in the lungs and seeping through to the placenta. In 2021, toxicologists warned that future studies urgently need to address what these pollutants are doing to our health, especially since exposure is now all but impossible to avoid. In 2022, a similar study also found that ingested polystyrene microplastics can accumulate in the brains of mice, triggering inflammation and impairing their memory. This study did not, however, identify any behavioral changes among mice during an open field test. Despite the discrepancies between results, Ross and her colleagues argue it is now evident polystyrene microplastics can travel to the mammal brain and exert detrimental effects after absorption. In their recent study, they found a protein called GFAP, which supports cells in the brain, had increased in abundance following the ingestion of microplastics. Ross says a decrease in GFAP has been associated with early stages of some neurodegenerative diseases, including mouse models of Alzheimer's disease, as well as depression. We were very surprised to see that the microplastics could induce altered GFAP signaling. Ross plans to investigate these concerning changes in future research. The study was published in the International Journal of Molecular Science.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
death toll from floods in eastern Libya rises to nearly 11,500, as another 10,000 people are still unaccounted for. Iran says that it will continue its positive cooperation with the UN nuclear agency, despite its decision to bar several IAEA inspectors based on safeguards agreements.